This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Author Augustine Burroughs has a habit of making his private life public. His memoir, Running with Scissors, traced his chaotic childhood with a mentally ill mother and his eventual guardianship by her psychiatrist. His best-selling book, Dry, chronicled the painful outcomes of his drinking and drug use and described his tumultuous journey to sobriety. His new book tackles an even more intimate topic, love. Lust and Wonder is a candid account of the complexity of three of his relationships and the very human experiences of finding, questioning, and embracing love. Augustine Burroughs speaks tonight at Burning Cold Theater at the Murphy School in Raleigh. That's at 7 o'clock, but first he joins us on the State of Things. Welcome back. It's good to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's so great to be back.
You know, it's kind of amazing. I mean, you've written three memoirs in one life,
right.
but it's so chock full, and again, taking different aspects. When you wrote this book, which is Lust and Wonder, about your endeavors at romance, do you start to see, even as you take notes, I know you're an avid journalist, you keep a journal, do you start to feel the sections of your life, the addiction part, the early years? I mean, does it come to you in segments?
It does, especially when I'm going back and reviewing work that I wrote years ago. You know, I not only see patterns in my own behavior, those sort of float to the surface, but I do begin to see my life in phases. Well, that was my phase that I was in advertising, and that was the phase that I was living, you know, with the crazy psychiatrist in childhood. And that was when I tried to get sober and failed. And that was – so it is. It becomes kind of episodic, especially because it's, you know – I mean, it is episodic. This actually has turned out – Lust and Wonder has really turned out to be – the third in a trilogy, and I never knew I would write a trilogy.
Well, this one is about relationships. Tell us why. Was that something that you had wanted to do, or again, a pattern that emerged and you thought, oh, well, this is what I need to
do? Well, you know, originally I was thinking I'd write a novel, and I was not happy with the development of that novel. It wasn't where I wanted it to be, so I wrote another one, and I didn't like it either. And then I got kind of blocked because I had decided, you know, I don't want to write more about myself. I should write fiction. I kind of bullied myself by thinking you've written too much about your life now. It's time for you to snap out of it and write a good novel, you know? Yeah. Write that good American, great American novel, or at least a good one.
Yeah.
And a friend suggested over dinner, why don't you write about what's happened to you since you've been sober? Because I've been sober, you know, since 1999. Yeah. And that just opened up sort of the floodgates because, in fact, so much had happened since I stopped drinking. At the end of Dry, which was my second memoir, it appears that I'm sober, and it was a really – I mean, I had been drunk since I was a teenager, very, very heavy drinker. I almost died from it, you know. I went through rehab, relapsed, and in Lust and Wonder, there's this sort of thing – I don't know what to call it – that this transformation that occurs when I sit down one morning and begin writing, and, you know – 4 days later, I'm not drinking. And 7 days later, I've written my first book and I never drank again. So it was this sort of, you know, looking for love is something I think that's been common in my life. Right. I didn't have a lot of it as a child. And so it all just sort of converged into the need to write this one.
Well, 9/11 was a crucial turning point in this book. Tell us how and the role that important date played for
you. Well, you know, I was freshly sober. I'd been sober for 9 months. And I had met and signed on with a literary agent who was, you know, has sold my first book, and I decided it was time to meet somebody. So I did. And right from the very beginning, there were questions about compatibility. But I was so optimistic, you know. I was like, well, you'll like me if you just get to know me more. I just felt sort of that almost I could shapeshift into what he wanted me to be. And, you know, I didn't trust my instincts anymore because I'd made so many bad choices in my life, so many drunk choices that how can I judge what's normal in a relationship? People talk about relationships being all about compromise. Well, that's what this relationship was. It was about compromise, you know. So he was very hesitant. And I think I was more aggressive in pushing for us to be together than 9/11 happened. And he was scheduled to be in the building on that day, but he had the wrong day. So he left right after the plane right after the first tower fell. So he made it home. And that's when I suggested, you know, we should move in together. And he was feeling very, you know, sort of shell-shocked, as I think everyone in the country was. But
But this is kind of a Rorschach test or throwing the bones for you, right? It's like, oh, fate has spoken. They
saved exactly what it was.
For me, and therefore, right?
I come from a state of mind, a place of being where, and this is because of my childhood, but I know, not only do I expect the carpet to be pulled out from underneath me, but I know it's going to be pulled out and I'm going to hit my head on a glass toffee table. So that was when that occurred. It felt, in my own sort of self-consumed, catastrophic thinking, it felt like a sign of the universe, like it's just not going to stop. So, I've got to sort of batten down the hatches. And
you tried hard to make it work, but it didn't. In fact, it's interesting. I mean, you talked about doing everything that would be necessary to make you attract. You took steroids at one point to like enhance your bottom.
Right.
Am I right?
Right. Yeah. Well, he liked sort of big muscular guys, and I'm just, I have sort of an anti-butt.
Yeah.
tall and lanky. So, yeah, I did. I took steroids to try to become larger and worked out at the gym. And I mean, I was really, not only trying to sort of shape my mind, but shape my body.
Right.
I sort of tried to take on his interests because, again, he represented, I think, stability and normalcy and, these qualities that were just deeply on sort of the brainstem level, very appealing. But I couldn't, I just could not trust myself. So I would think, well, I guess this must be normal. This must be what people do.
Is it, looking back on it now, does it feel like to you, you were falling in love with stability and normalcy? And
I was falling in love with the idea of someone and the idea of, what sort of the kind of life we had, the kind of life we could build. I mean, my career took off. It was very successful, and so I was very busy, very, very, very busy. And that allowed me to not think too much and not to prod, too much.
But there were signs along the way. It would have been, as you look back, it was pretty clear that you were not really romantically compatible.
No. I mean, we were not romantically compatible at all. It was a completely, almost completely asexual relationship. I mean, there was really no intimacy.
Yeah.
And so that's one sign that maybe something's wrong in your relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many other signs. I remember there's one scene in the book that we were walking back from the supermarket. It was a beautiful sunny day in New York City. And we just bought olives, at the market. And I said, are you as happy as I am? And there was sort of that beat, a little bit too much silence. And he said, well, probably not as happy as you, no. And, it just, that really was his way of saying, no.
Yeah, and you said in the book, I think you resented him.
I resented him for that. It was like, it was, I saw it really as holding back versus no, I'm not actually as happy.
Right. So you did go through a divorce, and it takes a while. And you describe a divorce as worse than death.
In some way it is because, having experienced both, death is absolutely, it's appalling. It leaves you with holes, almost feeling like physical holes in the center of your being. But there is a finality to it because no matter how desperately and absolutely you want to reach back to that person you lost, it is simply not within the realm of possibility. With divorce, it's just ever so slightly more complicated because if they're still alive, you can. So it's different. It's different. But in some ways for me at that time, it was just even a little more awful.
You were able to move on.
I did move on. And what happened is that my literary agent that I had met 10 years before this, I was in this relationship with Dennis for 10 years, but I met this literary agent and I kind of fell in love with him the first minute I met him, but I couldn't because he's my agent. And so I spent all this time sort of squashing those feelings down. And so these two paths sort of converged, the end of one relationship and this just sort of insane explosion. I could not contain myself anymore. I could not deny what I felt. All these things I had refused to look at, refused to feel. It's like you can't in life, you cannot in life choose whom you're going to love or not love. I mean, you can try. but it'll come out.
Did you trust yourself at that point? You talked about coming out of addiction and worried that you could even trust yourself. Now you've had, you know, a relationship that has gone, has ended, and now you're entering a new one. What was your sense of your ability to pick them?
It was just absolute diamond, you know, perfect carbon clarity. That's the thing. When you spend so much time deliberately trying to not know something, that moment that the sort of fog lifts and you can actually see the truth. I mean, the truth is the thing that often hides behind the thing you think is true or want to be true or need so much to be true. The actual, real, rock bottom, elemental, undivisible, indivisible truth is, as soon as you see it, you just know. It's like there's almost like a tone that vibrates in the bones of your sternum, and it's, you know, so fully. And that was really the feeling I had, despite all the madness and the poor decisions that I'd experienced in my life and made in my life. I knew I loved my agent, you know, I knew it. And there was no stopping it.
You know, speaking of agents, I actually want to take you back to a kind of comic moment earlier in the book, not about the agent in question here, but this email that you erroneously sent to an agent that, you know, was going to handle your book. And, you know, this could have been the big break. And oh, no.
Right. It was horrifying. I mean, I had tried, you know, I'd gone through the guide to literary agents, which is like a phone book. And I'd basically, you know, emailed them like it was publisher sweepstakes. And all of them rejected me except one. And one wrote back, and it was a very sort of hesitant, you know, approval. It was like, well, there are things about this I like. I would be willing to take you on, you know, on a conditional basis and maybe send it to one or two publishers. So I immediately emailed my friend who's a writer, and I said, wow, so, but doesn't it seem like this agent here is willing to lift, you know, like maybe a finger, like a portion of a finger? He'll lift one half of a little finger, but like no more than that. Plus, why does he mention the cost of postage stamps, that I'll be responsible for all postage? It just seems like, couldn't he be some, you know, child molester in his underwear in Hell's Kitchen in New York? And I hit send, and I had actually placed the text into the wrong email, and I'd sent it to him and not my friend. So I immediately wrote him back and said, obviously I'm mentally unstable and don't deserve you or any agent at all. I am so sorry. And I never heard back.
An assessment he agreed with because you didn't hear
awful,
back.
Awful.
That's one mistake. Christopher is who we're talking about now, the agent in question, who faced considerable health challenges. How did you approach that?
You know, he became HIV positive in the 80s. And in Dry, I wrote about a relationship with someone named Pighead who also was HIV positive, and I decided, you know, after Pighead died, well, never again. So when Christopher told me, you know, I had this huge crush on him at first, but it seemed impossible. He's my agent. And then as we became closer and closer friends, my sort of insane crush on him ran into a brick wall when he told me he was HIV positive. And I thought, oh, well, no, never again. So I just decided to sort of maintain this catalog of his flaws. You know, like one day I was in his office and he grabbed a little step stool to pick up a book from a bookshelf. And I thought, well, what is he doing that for? Like, what reasonable grown man needs a little step stool unless he's short? Is he short? And of course I saw that he was short. Yeah. When it all burst after my relationship with Dennis, and I realized, not only do I not care that he's HIV positive, I admire it. I admire the incredible, you know, strength. I mean, he's like, he's got the attitude of like a surfer dude. He's very laid back and incredibly positive. He had cancer. Nothing beats him down. And I realized that was one of the most precious things about him. It was one of the things that made him, you know, kind of heroic and also kind of like a cockroach, you know, sturdy.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, revelations like that make me wonder what you have learned about love. I mean, you talked earlier about sort of not having intimacy in a relationship, but you get to the point where that doesn't matter. And then you get to, you can in a relationship as you get to know someone and then sort of trying to sculpt your body to be right. I'm wondering now to what extent being with the other person, growing together, is any part of making a love relationship and not feeling in your sternum as you did initially.
Right.
That's one thing, right?
I never understood sex. You know, I was molested as a child, and I think maybe that's what set me off on the wrong course or the wrong, you know, the lack of understanding. But once when I was with Christopher, the intimacy, I understood for the first time what therapists had said for years and what I'd heard on talk shows, you know, which is that, you know, love and sex need to be joined. They shouldn't be separated. They need to be joined. I understood and experienced, oh, sex is really just wanting to be as close as you possibly can to this person. That was a revelation. I never got it. Never got it. You know, and here I am, middle-aged, feeling like that. And it has nothing to do with body and nothing to do with looks. And, you know, now it's like, I'm happy if I can have a gigantic family-sized bag of potato chips every day. That's great. That's how much I care about, you know, that aspect of my being now. It's not about that anymore. It's not about looks. It's not about any of that. It's about instead this incredible deep connection, this intimacy and this, you know.
Well, you talked about Christopher's courage and being able to kind of go through it all. But it seems to me that you've shown a great amount yourself, having been through all of those things. Anybody could have shut it down and said, look, intimacy, I just can't move forward. And you did it a couple of times and kept yourself open and kept yourself vulnerable. And now sort of have learned all these deep insights that, again, everybody's heard. But
right. I have a lot of hope is the thing. You know, I think for some reason I've got just a lot of hope, even when things are really, really broken in my life. I always feel that, you know, this could change. I mean, I've had enough experiences in my life where, you know, I kind of turn around or I step on the foot of the person who then changes my life. Mm. Life is really like that. You never know who's behind you in line at the supermarket. You know, I mean, literally, you could turn around because you dropped a penny on the floor and look up and there's your wife, your future wife, or there's your future husband. And that truth about life, I think, it weighs a lot inside of me. So I think that's maybe, you know, where this hope that just does not get squashed out comes from.
You've shown great talent and ability to write the memoir. This is your third now, Lust and Wonder. Are you going to turn your talents to fiction?
I am, you know, and I'm currently working on yet two more novels. But, you know, the thing about fiction that's interesting for me is that it offers so much freedom that it's a little paralyzing because it reminds me of my childhood, in fact, where I had no bedtime. I didn't go to school. There was no one to tell me what to do or what to say. So I had absolute freedom from the ages of, you know, 12 on. And when you have absolute freedom, it's kind of like what I imagine having profound, profound wealth would be like. Because if you can literally purchase anything you want, anything, whether it's a car or a chain of restaurants, and the amount you have to pay is insignificant because you have vast resources, then everything in life becomes literally without value. Mm. If you can have everything, well, you've really got to then see what floats to the surface. And fiction writing is like that in a way because you can create any world you want. It can be in the past. It can be in the present. It can be in the future. It can be, you know, experimental. It can be, I mean, all my interests in science and history and human relationships and dogs and, you know, gemstones. You can go anywhere. So there's this sort of, wow, I've got to take a breath and see what floats to the
surface. Is there any discipline or structure? Again, you talked about the patterns in your own journals, the kind of rulemaking that you could do and sort of take a look at those journals and say, oh, here are these patterns, and then write rules. I don't know how you, when you write fiction, how do you deal with that sense of the abyss? There's just too much space here, too much freedom.
I have a lot of starts, you know, and a lot of middles of things. And I look for things that things that interest me over periods of time, over long periods of time. Because to write, you know, you've got to be able to enter a world so completely that world is more real to you than the brick and mortar world that we occupy. When you're writing, it's an odd experience. It is the ultimate sort of escape, but it also requires the utmost focus and concentration. And this leap of faith. So I've got to find a world that I really, really love or want to create.
Well, welcome back when you finish that.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to have you back. Augustine Burroughs is the author of Lust and Wonder. He's going to be speaking tonight at Burning Coal Theater at the Murphy School in Raleigh at 7 o'clock. You can find out details about that visit and the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Triangle-based jazz group, the Second Line Stompers, live on the State of Things. Stay with us.